Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Topically yours on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. I'm Georgia Shuley, your host. And well, you know, even though the sun is out, it's March, and you know the weather is always unpredictable. The temperature has dropped, but I'm hoping to warm you up via this show. We have as our guest an actress and singer who has charted quite an impressive career within the entertainment industry. She has appeared opposite Richard Pryor in Which Way Is Up and Brewster's Millions. She has worked with famed director Francis Ford Coppola in The Cotton Club and Gardens of Stone, a movie that starred James Earl Jones and Angelica Houston, and in Jekyll Fever, Malcolm X, and She Hates Me. And that was a film for noted filmmaker Spike Lee. A Detroit resident, Lynette McKee, will be appearing in the Oak Room at the Algonquin Hotel, where she will be singing songs from her films and Broadway shows, as well as some of her own original melodies. And if you want to catch her there, make your reservation by calling 212-419-9331 or go online at www.algonquinhotel.com. And if you don't know how to spell Algonquin, it's Algonquin. And that's, again, www.algonquinhotel.com. And, well, you know what? Lynette has joined me, and so let's give her a warm welcome. How are you, Lynette?
Thank you, Deirdre. I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure. Well, you know, I guess one of my questions should be is, what haven't you done in the entertainment business? From what I've seen, you've acted in film and on stage, television. You've worked in music as a singer, musician, producer, and composer. You've even scored written songs for films and infomercials. I went through your listing and I said, my goodness.
Well, you know, I think in this industry, the more things we can become proficient at, the more we will work and the higher the chances to succeed.
And get paid.
Exactly.
Yes, I agree with you there. The more proficient you are, the better off you are. But tell me, did you originally plan to have a career in music rather than film?
I did. I started out in Detroit, Michigan, very young, writing and playing, about 5 years old. And then my mom took me around and I was on stage conducting the orchestras and playing piano and playing my compositions and singing, like between the ages of 5 and 9. And then I started going in the studio with the neighborhood kids who wanted to be producers. And by the time I was 13 here in Detroit, I had a hit record.
Get out of here.
Yeah, sure.
Sounds
did.
Like you were a child prodigy.
Well, that's what they say. I don't like to say that of myself, but that is what I have been told. But yes,
well,
indeed, I absolutely did think that I was going to make my mark in the music industry. But, you know, that was back in the day. And at that time, they were very restrictive in terms of what they wanted you to do. So the question that kept being posed to me was, well, are you a writer, singer, or are you an actor? Once I did Sparkle, it became about, are you an actor or a writer or musician? And I was like, well, why can't I be both? And in,
exactly.
at that time...
I was asking you if your mom was a stage mom or she just recognized your talent.
She was kind of both. She recognized my talent, but she also kind of tried to be a stage mom. But we really had no idea what we were doing in the early days in Detroit. So we just kind of winged it. But she certainly is very much responsible for getting my career started. My parents were very supportive.
Were they also musically inclined, or were they?
No one in my family was. No. Mm-mm.
Or in show business?
Nope.
Wow, that's very interesting. Oh, that's
mm-hmm,
why she didn't know how to get you started, but apparently she found out.
Yeah, she did. I think we found out the hard way. You know, she did her best. She tried, but we were pretty naive. Obviously, I was. I was a kid, and she was too. But we managed.
Now, tell me, the first record I see that you've done was called Stop, Don't Worry About It.
Mm-hmm. That was the hit I had when I was 13, 14, regional hit out of Detroit. And that was produced by the team of Dennis Coffey and Mike Theodore, whom I later reunited with and worked again on my first album on the Sussex label for Clarence Avant.
Wow, very nice.
So I've worked with them a lot. Yes, it was very nice.
Well, I want to play for the audience one of your songs, and it's called Watch the Birds.
Okay. And those are my real birds that you hear on that song.
Oh, really?
Yes, I rescue birds. All my life I've rescued birds. And those are my babies. I went in the room with a DAT recorder and I said, okay, talk for mommy. This is going to go on her album. And they did.
Well, we have to talk about your bird rescue when the song is over. That sounds interesting.
Okay. Great.
And here we go. Lynette McKee, Watch the Birds. Well, it seems like the bird watching is a little difficult. I can't get that going. All right, well, I'll have to come back to that since I can't get the music to play.
Okay. You want to talk about the birds in the interim?
Yeah, let's talk about the birds in the interim.
Well,
how did you get started with that?
I don't have children. I decided early on, I mean, I definitely respect the job of parenting. I think it's the most important job anyone could ever have is raising children. But for me, that was not my calling. I've always been an avid animal lover, and somehow, not to compare animals to children, I don't want to do that, but for me, you know, the love of the birds and the animals very much substituted, if you will, for probably what a lot of parents feel for their children. That's what I feel for my animals. And I just have a soft spot for them. I feel that we don't treat them very well, and they're kind of the misbegotten. And I think some of us are called upon by God or the universe to step forward and do that. So I heeded the call, and I've been doing that for years. And what's funny, Deirdre, is I don't go out looking to rescue birds. They come to me. I'll open my front door. Yes, it's very tender. It's very precious. I'll open my door in the front to go out in the morning, and there'll be a sick bird or an injured bird sitting on my porch. Or I'll be walking down the street in New York, and a bird will just walk up to me that won't be able to fly.
Wow.
And they let me pick
each other.
Yeah, I think they do. And they let me pick them up, and I take them home, and I do what I can for them. If they need to go to the vet, I take them. And then, of course, my goal is to release them to the wild as soon as possible. But a lot of times that's not possible. I have one bird by the name of Boot the Hip-Hop Robin who has a broken wing, and he'll never fly. So he's a lifelong treasure for me. And it's funny, his name came because, you know, robins learn. They're not born knowing how to sing their beautiful bird song. They pick it up from their parents and from being outside. Well, Boot was raised from such a little nestling with me. He didn't understand how to do the robin singing. So he would listen to me, and what I was playing was hip-hop music. a lot of hip-hop music. So Boot started singing a hip-hop song.
Wow.
Yeah, so I named him Boot the Hip-Hop Robin. And I also have written a script about him, which I hope to get, you know, funded and out in the next few years. It's going to be an animated, and it's going to be good for kids.
Wow. Well, you've done that sounds wonderful. And, you know, I like trees. I take all kinds of pictures of trees.
Oh, that's good. I love trees.
Well, they just sort of look like beautiful goddesses to me for some reason, and their arms are always outstretched to the divine, like in a form of prayer.
Very much so. And, you know, some of the cultures dating back to ancient times believe that if you hug, literally stand next to a tree and put your arms around it, your energy will be revitalized and you will connect to the earth and to the heavens, and it gives you good energy and strength. And I believe that. Yeah. Makes sense to me.
I can be very spiritual, so I
feel plugged into nature, especially since I was raised on a farm.
Oh, yeah. I had a farm.
Did you?
I love country. I did. I had a farm in Hope, New Jersey. Had horses, a tractor.
Wow, you really had a farm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we raised chickens and pigs and cows and ducks and, well, rabbits. Mm-hmm. We had two, and then we had 100 practically.
Yes, I've heard.
they're really prolific.
And I love nature. Don't you love nature? Don't you love being in that environment?
Oh, yeah. If I could, I would have the farm again. You know, I would,
yes,
my
me
brother
too.
Is still there, but I would definitely go back there. And maybe
one day
I
you
will buy a little land. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's my goal. I want to get back out to the country. Yeah. I mean, I love New York City. Don't get me wrong. I love New York City, and I love my hometown, which is where I am now, which is Detroit. Hello, Detroit. Oh, listen, you know what, Deirdre? Before I forget, I want to give a big thank you and a shout-out to Ted for hooking us up, and a shout-out to all our Facebook friends, because, you know, we have a lot of friends on Facebook.
I know. That's where I usually put the show after it's done, so they get a chance to hear it.
Yes, and I think a lot of them will be listening to us today between you and I, that, you know, we have a pretty big following on Facebook and a lot of friends. So shout out to all the Facebook friends. Hey, guys.
Well, hello, Facebook friends. And also, if I can't get the music up, I'll dub it in later, guys. So when you listen to it, it'll all be packaged and together.
Thank you.
Do not despair.
Thank you.
But I am in the process of trying to upload it now as we're talking, though. So we'll move on and come back to that. And, well, as you said, you've been in the film business, and you've worked with people like, well, some really impressive people, directors and filmmakers like Spike Lee and Francis Ford Coppola, Hal Prince.
Mm-hmm.
And I may not have this guy's name correct. It's Bertrand Tavernier.
Bertrand Tavernier.
Oh, almost it was there. Almost there. Well,
that was good. You were good.
With them.
You did very well.
Oh, thank you. Tell me about working with Francis Ford Coppola.
Oh, Francis is a big teddy bear. He's a wonderful man. He's a loving, kind, warm human being. And all my memories of Francis are wonderful, just wonderful. He's very open, and he's very good with actors. I remember when we were doing The Cotton Club, we were locked in Astoria Studios for like 7 months doing that film.
Yeah.
And Francis was always open to the actors coming to him with rewritten dialogue and ideas for scenes. And he used to cook in his trailer. He used to make pasta and feed us in his trailer. Gregory Hines and I were always hanging out in his trailer with him. He's a wonderful man and so creative, such a gifted filmmaker. And now his daughter is a gifted filmmaker, Sophia. And she was a baby when I worked with Francis.
Wow. And there's something about that, because you have to have a perspective of life to make a film and see, put the characters together and you know what I'm saying?
I know exactly
what
you're
saying.
To be
able to bring everybody together and put the picture out there.
Yes,
and tell
I mean
the story.
Even Absolutely. Even starting with, in terms of filmmaking, writing, I'm writing screenplays now. And I got to tell you, it's like playing 12 games of chess at the same time.
But you have to do a description of a picture.
Well, the trick is with screenwriting, the trick to know is that you've only got, now they're cutting it down to like 90 to 100 pages is what's acceptable when you submit a screenplay. And any experienced reader will not be very interested if it goes much over maximum 120 pages. So even like people that do rewrites on novels and they do remakes, that's a very difficult job because in a novel you have complete writer's artistic freedom. You can take as long as you need on that page to describe any given character or situation. In screenwriting, you've got 90 to 100 to maximum 120 pages to get the whole story in. So structure is very, very important. And as you know, as a writer, it's all about editing. You know, you start by writing everything down, all your ideas, all your characters, all your thoughts. And as you go, week by week, day by day, you start whittling that down to what's really important and what keeps the story moving forward. And it's tricky.
It's very tricky.
Yes, it is. Indeed.
Now, Spike must be a completely different type of filmmaker than Mr. Coppola.
Like,
they're two different personalities, but is he more off the cuff?
No, actually, Francis was more off the cuff.
Oh,
Spike is a little more structured, but Spike still is the good filmmakers are pretty much into the same thing. We all feel it's very important. Of course, I put myself in that group. We great filmmakers. but those of us who know.
Well, you have to think it to make it be.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Think a thing and so shall it be. But I feel, and especially coming from an actor's perspective, given that that's what I did for so many years, rehearsal is everything. The worst thing for an actor is to walk on a screen set cold on the first day of shooting and have to like do a love scene with somebody you've never laid eyes on prior to the makeup room that morning at 6 a.m. So rehearsals are very important, and you work out a lot of kinks in your writing when you get good actors in a room together. And I always want to be open. I mean, I always, like Francis does and like Spike does, I want to be open to their input because that's when you'll get your best work. Filmmaking is such a team effort. Certainly the director rules on films, whereas in stage, the writer rules. But in films, the director rules. So what you want to do is be able to delegate responsibility quickly because the clock is always ticking on film. It's always ticking. I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars a day, every minute, are ticking by. So you really don't have a lot of margin for a lot of mistakes when you're filmmaking because the stakes are too high. The budgets are too high. You can't afford to mess up. So it's always smarter to get your actors in the room, get the scenes down, start rehearsing it, and then as a writer-director, you'll know what's going to work and what's not, and you set up all your shots that way. You're thinking about, how am I going to shoot this? You know, how am I going to cover this?
Well, Hal Prince also, you spoke of theater. Isn't he? He works in theater, doesn't he? He's not so much in film.
Yes, he's one of the greatest director-producers in theater of all times. He is it. Hal Prince rules in Broadway, in that medium. And he's wonderful. He's another one. You know, it's really funny. What I found, Deirdre, is the most gifted, the most ingenious creative people are usually the kindest. They're the nicest. They're the warmest. They're the easiest to work with. They're not prima donnas. They're very loving people. On the other hand, I've worked with a few people who aren't so gifted, and they're not so loving and so kind either. It's almost like their own insecurities and their own problems seep into the workplace. And everything filters down in a film and Broadway show from your director. In film, it's not from the writer, because the director has the power to bring in other writers on film and tweak things and do things to your screenplay. Whereas in Broadway, usually it's the writer and director right there on top. But I have found that on a happy set, where there's a where it's very there's a lot of harmony,
congenial,
and goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
I said congenial.
Exactly. It filters down from your director. If you got a jerk director, everybody's mad on the set. The crew is mad. And you know, people have to remember, when you're watching a film, you're sitting there watching it on TV and you're watching one or two people do a scene. Well, on the other side of that camera, there's like 100, 150 guys standing behind that camera. So if it doesn't all work like clockwork, like a well-oiled machine, there's going to be a problem. And all that vibe filters down from the director.
Oh, yeah, here it comes. This is Watch the Bird.
When I was a child in the ghetto, and I'd reach for the stars, kept telling me, oh no, you better not go, you better not stay very far. Oh, I'd sit alone and I watch the birds.
Thank you. I guess I don't have to tell you what I was thinking about when I wrote and programmed that one.
I
was
know
definitely
is that it,
a bird brain that day.
I'll tell you, it seemed like the music was had a broken wing, but it finally repaired itself, or
it did.
Needed for you to make it well.
It did. Oh, well, thank you. Hold that thought.
Exactly. Now, I want to talk about some of the people that you've worked with over the years, Lou Gossett
sure.
Jr. and James Earl Jones and Robert De Niro, Cuba Gooding Jr.
And Denzel.
Wow, he's always wonderful.
Yep,
and
Halle.
Halle Berry.
Yep, Gregory Hines.
Can't leave Oprah out.
No, can't leave Oprah out on Women of Brewster Place, which just aired all over the country about a week ago, I believe.
Mm-hmm. It must be nice to get feedback.
Oh, it's, you know, I got to tell you, at this stage of the game, it's very much what keeps an actor and a performer going. You know, it's when people come up to me on the street and want a hug, and they yell out, "Sister!" on the street, and, you know, like all our Facebook friends, how supportive they are and kind they are. It's really wonderful. That's what I do it for, other than my creative expression, okay? For me, if I didn't have an audience at all, if I wasn't able to put out my records or whatever, I would still sit at home on my Triton and write music and program, because it's something that has to come out of me. It's my creativity, and it has to flow. But the bottom line is, when you do start getting out there and performing it for people, it's their feedback that keeps you going. Because, you know, this is a rough industry. And many times, a couple of years have gone by where I didn't work. Part of it was me. I turned down the riffraff stuff and the fluff. I didn't want to do it. But a big part of it is, in this industry, it's still and always has been, and I don't know how long this is going to go on, but it really needs to stop. That's why I started writing, because I felt like the roles are so horrible that they offer women of color, especially after a certain age. I got so mad a few years ago, about 10, 15 years ago, I had an agent, excuse my French, but an asshole agent in New York that sent me a screenplay to play somebody's maid.
What?
And I was like, yeah. And, you know, and don't get me wrong, my position on that is, all work is noble. There is nothing wrong with doing housework if that's what you're doing and that's what you need to do. And if I had to do it, I would be out doing it. There's nothing wrong with that. But in this day and age, for white agents to offer an artist of my credentials the role of a menial role of playing a maid, it's just ridiculous. It made me mad, and that's when I sat down and started writing. I said, okay. I got it. I get it. I get
well, do you
it.
Remember,
you know, you don't.
Do you remember Juanita Moore from Imitation of Life?
Of course. Of course.
She got an Academy Award, and I interviewed her, and she was telling me that even after she got the award, the roles they offered her were still maids.
Of course. Especially in that day.
Right.
I mean, that's just where they saw us, and that's where they had us, and that's where they wanted to keep us. And I still feel a lot of that is going on in the film industry because what happened is a few years ago, all the actually creative people that ran the studios, there weren't that many to begin with, but those that were running the studios, they're no longer there. The big studios, Universal and all those, were taken over by corporate executives, people like the guy who owns Seagram's bought Universal and Viacom.
So mostly
and it's like, pardon?
Mostly finance guys and accountants who don't have the creative spark in them.
No, they don't. They don't have a creative bone in their body. So these are the people that are in charge of greenlighting projects and deciding who gets their film made or who gets their script done or whatever. So, you know, there's not very much simpatico from those guys to the artistic community, not the
it's
actors or the writers.
Isn't it about what they think is going to make money? That's probably
it
all
is.
They care about
it is.
The money.
Yes, and those of us on the creative side, we can't produce based on that. I mean, you know, you'd be foolish to put out stuff that you know in your heart absolutely will never sell, ever. I mean, just, you know, bad stuff. But you certainly can't sit down to begin writing a screenplay or a song with that in mind. You know, it has to be an expression of your creativity, first and foremost.
I'm hoping that my music is going to work for all of them, and I'm going to try. Maybe there are reasons.
Okay, I'm doing that at the Algonquin. I might do Watch the Birds, too, at the Algonquin.
Oh, do that. That song is nice.
I'm going to play Maybe There Are Reasons on the Acoustic Grand at the Algonquin, the one you're about to play. I'm going to play that myself.
Well, fantastic, because not only, again, you're a musician, too.
Yep.
What can't this gal do?
Thank you for giving me the airtime with them. But you know one thing I do want to add, since we just had the conversation about, you know, basically being discriminated against in the industry, I do want to make a note and make a point to say that, you know, not all people of non-color are like that.
Oh,
I mean,
yes,
now I have a great team representing me, and they're the first ones to admit how racist the industry still is. And they're not black folks, but they know, because they know what they're up against when they make a phone call on my behalf, you know, to try to put the feelers out for work or whatever. They know. They know. We all know what's going on.
I just did a show not so long ago, I guess it was earlier this month or last month, with some black promoters who were also complaining about how they're treated.
Oh, yeah.
Music promoters.
I mean, you know, I guess we have to look at it we have to keep it in perspective. It's not right and it's horrible, but when you think about that, just, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, we weren't allowed to sit in the front of the bus or to vote. So,
it's not that long ago.
It's not that long ago. So anyone that denies that we're living in a racist society and that there is institutionalized racism is either in denial or they're just flat out lying, or they're one of the racists. Because, you know, this is our everyday battle. But it can be fought.
But it's sad that children are not picking up on that like they should, that they don't know their history like they should.
Well, that's because they're phasing it out of all the textbooks in the schools. Purposefully. I don't know who started that or who got behind it or whatever, but they're trying to take out Native American history out of the history books in the schools.
All non-colored people.
Yeah, exactly. All people of color, they want them out of those books.
Oh, yeah,
they
should
not want
all people of color, rather.
Yeah, they don't want our history to be told to the young kids coming up. So
yeah,
that's a shame.
Well, you know, that's why they say it's his story, because it's not ours.
Yeah. But yet we're so connected. We're so connected. Everything that happens to us today, is because of what happened to our parents and our grandparents before us. We're all products of our ancestry one way or the other. And I think it's very important to teach our children where we come from, what has happened to us, when we made our strides and our milestones, and what happened, that, you know, the truth.
I'm not sure how many black people are doing that as they should. I mean, there's certainly enough black history information out there and shows. Blake Radio itself has some wonderful historians that come on and talk about the history. In fact, I'm getting ready to edit someone's book who's talking about Granville Woods, who invented the third rail on the train track. A lot of people don't even know that was a black man
sure.
who did that. And the
there
roller
you go.
Coaster.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know.
Didn't we invent blood transfusions as well?
Exactly.
Blood transfusions, a lot of stuff.
A lot.
Broom.
The iron, the, you know, all of this
yeah.
stuff that designed Washington, practically.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's a lot of things that we did that you will never... I'm told that it was a black lady that came up with the Coca-Cola syrup.
I think I know about that, too. Yes, I believe that's rooted in fact.
Mm-hmm. And some say, was it Beethoven or Mozart was black?
Yes, I believe it was Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
Who is black, as well as one of our presidents. I forget what one, but the word is out that he was as well.
Well, they say the original ones before Washington, there were some before Washington that were also, I mean, president, but they never came to, you know, glory.
Mm-hmm.
Several people, when they were first trying to get the Constitution and get this a country together, that were ruling things. And blacks were in politics right after slavery, but they don't talk about that much.
No, they don't. They don't. But, you know, that goes back, again, that goes back to the history of what this country was built on, which was it was built on us being enslaved and our ancestors being enslaved with their blood and sweat. And the you know, Caucasians in this country who ran the country, they're hard-pressed to let that go. They didn't want to let it go then. And to a large extent, they unfortunately still don't.
Well, look how they're treating Obama, one of the most... After the buffoon they had before Obama,
oh, please.
It's amazing that they can even sit up there and attack him when he is so intelligent and articulate. And no matter
and
what
eloquent.
He does, they checkmate. Yeah.
Of course.
Look how they
of course. He's
him.
An eloquent, kind man, and his wife is beautiful. His children, they're wonderful. And I can't find a damn thing wrong with any of them. And yet the Caucasian sector of this country continually tries to pick him apart. And, of course, that's what the Tea Party, I believe, was born out of, resentment for him getting in.
Of course. I mean, they would go after another moron, Palin, who
oh my
clearly
God.
Doesn't know what she's talking about.
Don't even start me. The wolf killer?
She's like a paid agitator. Clearly, she follows the money. As soon as she got offers for money, she was off out of that governorship. What does that tell you about
how she
cares about her people?
Oh, yeah, I mean, she walked away.
People?
Yeah, she walked away from her elected office. I mean, she's totally fluff and riffraff. And
the money.
Not even, yeah, she's not even savvy riffraff, I have to say. She's just downright dumb.
Indeed.
If she comes on the news, I have to change channels.
Well, I hope since Giffords she's shut up somewhat. Because that thing about targeting her constituents with the crosshairs of a rifle, that's outrageous.
Yeah, well, I think she's a little bit insane, if you want to know the truth.
Well, she denied it, but as soon as it came out, she took it off. So what does that tell you? She knew.
She's a mess. I think she needs to crawl back under that rock she came out from and go back to her rightful place.
We'll stop picking on her because we want to be above the fray.
Yes, that's right.
And be kind to her. But tell me about your Oak Room engagement.
Oh, I'm real excited about that. I open on April 5th at 8:30 and on Friday, and I'm there through April 30th. And the shows run Tuesday through Saturday at 8:30, and on Friday and Saturday I'm doing a second show at 11. And as you mentioned, I'm going to be doing a lot of standards as well as my Broadway fare and stuff from the Lady Day show I did and my own stuff. I'm going to sit at the keyboard for a few songs and play these songs that you just played and along with others.
You have recorded some CDs?
Yes, I have two. Those songs are right now on a CD that I just released called Acoustic Tracks, and they're available at cdbaby.com. And the first song you played, Watch the Birds, is available on my CD called Lonette McKee, and that also is available at cdbaby.com.
Okay, we want to mention that so that people can get that if they like the music they're hearing on the show. And speaking of that, I think I'm going to play another song.
Okay.
Which is, let's stay on topic. The Colors of Love.
Oh, yeah, I'm opening the show with that.
Oh, all right. Well, here we go with Lonette McKee. For those of you that didn't know that she sang as well as acted, listen up.
Writing is my first love.
You're talking to a writer here, so.
I know you know.
Colors of Love. Catch it. right. That was like all a right. pop tune. I liked it.
Thank you. That's on the acoustic tracks album because I did that with all live musicians, all acoustic. No electronic programming on that one.
It sounds like it was fun doing. I want to identify the station. It's theblakeradio.com, Rainbow Soul. And we're talking to Lynette McKee about her music and her craft. And go ahead. What were you about to say?
I was just going to say I love musicians. I love musicians. Put me in a room with musicians and a piano, and it's on.
Well, speaking of that, you performed with the icon, Sarah Vaughan.
Oh, yes. When I did the my first real, outside of doing my record here in Detroit when I was 13, 14, my first real big gig was on a show called The Wacky World of Jonathan Winters. And I was teamed with another wonderful woman by the name of Michelle Delafave, who's coming to the show. We're still friends. And they put us together, and she was the same stature as me. I'm tall, you know, and at that time I was very thin, real thin. I'm 5'10", and she's 5'10", and she was very thin at the time. So they put us together, and she's this platinum blonde with these big blue eyes, and I'm this dark, you know, haired, olive-complected girl. And they put us together and called us the Soul Sisters. And what we did, we were regulars on the show every week, and our job was to sing. We did our own numbers, and then they would have various guest stars every week on the show. People like Dean Martin, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, John Denver, all these fabulous people came on. So I got to perform with all these people at a very young age, because I think I was around 16 or 17 when I did that show.
Was Malcolm May and Cab Calloway and Dizzy Gillespie and Rosemary Clooney on that show?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. Yeah, but actually I worked with Cab. No, I first met Cab and worked with him when I went to do a big jazz festival over in Europe. And then Cab wanted me to come back like 2 months, 3 months later to go on a tour with him in Europe and open his show, which I did. I was so happy to do. I was honored to do it. I love Cab. For those of you who never saw Cab live, he was mind-blowing. He was mind-blowing. He was the bebop king with the charts of life. And the guy that did his charts ended up doing Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill with me, Danny Holgate. He's still a very good friend of mine. And Danny did all of Cab's charts. Of course, Cab was also a great musician and did a lot of his own charts. But boy, he and Danny, they tore that live show up with those bebop horns. I mean, it was phenomenal. I wasn't ready for what he did.
Something too. Isn't his son continuing his act?
No, I believe his daughter, Chris Calloway, is the singer.
I know. He also has a son.
Does he have a son that's working?
Cab. Yeah, I've interviewed him. He dresses up just like Cab, and he's got the whole suit on, and yeah, he does the whole number.
Oh, see, now this is news to me. I don't know where I've been.
I have to look.
This is complete news to me.
I have to look his name up again. It's been so long since I interviewed him, but yeah, I have a picture. I'll send it to you.
Oh, please, yeah, send me the information, because if he's playing anywhere where I am, I'll definitely go and pay my respects to he and his dad.
Oh, okay.
Boy, I loved his father. I loved his father. Of course, I didn't know him on a personal level, but of course, he and his wife on this tour in Europe, I got to know them fairly well on the road. But what
a
wonderful performer.
I also want to mention, because to me it's very interesting, is the PBS project that you did with the Manhattan African Burial Ground. Now, I know you scored the music, but did you look up the history?
I looked up some of the history at the time. I wanted to do my research, but what was most startling for me and disturbing, it was a very moving experience for me, was they took us down into the actual excavation area, which they had, you know, roped off and guarded off, and they took us down like about two or three stories down, and I actually saw the remains of our ancestors, and what was really sad was the way they buried them at that time, because this was like back in the 16, 1700s. First of all, they completely stripped us of our African names, We didn't have names. We took the names of our slave owners. That's why my last name is McKee. My father is a McKee, probably an Irish slave owner. But what they did was they buried them one on top of the other with no earth in between. They were just layered remains,
like
one on
there?
Top of yes, and some of the female skeletal remains actually still had little infants in their arms. And the only thing it was really, really disturbing for me. It still haunts me. And the only thing that you could see that might identify the remains were that some of the women still had African-style bracelets on around their wrists. And
wow.
I tell you, that was really, that did it for me. That did it for me. That made me painfully aware of our history, and I will never, ever forsaken it or forget it or not talk about it or not relate all the racism that I face in this day and age back to that. That's the way they forced us to come over here.
Exactly.
And
I was about to say they laid you on the boat that way, too. Can you imagine a voyage that took forever like that, chained and laid on top of each other in a
like cigars, like packed in like sardines. Yeah.
How horrible.
They weren't allowed to go to the bathroom. They had to lay there in their own feces. And so clearly we are a strong people.
That must have been horrific.
Oh, it was horrible. A lot of them, a lot of the slaves threw themselves over the boat when they got a chance because they couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
But also,
but nevertheless,
and also,
we're still a very strong people.
That's why we're so strong. I think that's one
sure
of the
reasons.
You're
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, too, and that's why I encourage, if there's young people listening to this show, learn about your history. You know, this nonsense of pulling your pants down and walking around looking like idiots. I mean, come on. You come from kings and queens and a great history, and you're behaving like that. It's a shame, and really. And this N-word thing, we died being called that, humiliated being called that. It has blood on it. It's murder. Murder. Never call yourselves that because too many of your ancestors were murdered under that name.
That's right. And not that long ago, in the 60s, they were hosing us down with fire hoses. And there still are some places, I've heard about this anyway, I haven't seen them, but there still are places in the Deep South where they have for colors and for whites only.
Oh, they in Texas. It wasn't that long ago. They dragged that guy behind the truck. It wasn't that far.
Yep, and they dragged another one in Florida.
Yeah, so that's it's still ongoing. And as
it is, and that's what scares me about these Tea Party people. They're so right wing extremists that they're a heartbeat away from doing that type of stuff. I mean, it still goes on. That you know, a policeman here was it a fireman or a policeman here a couple of years ago. Found a noose in his locker.
Mm-hmm.
A hangman's noose was put in his locker at a police station here in Detroit by other police.
You go out to Far Rockaway in New York and incidents are happening. I mean, there are people being gunned down. I personally don't understand, like, why you have to shoot to kill the police officers. Why can't they shoot to wound?
Well, they want to shoot to kill. That's why.
That's what I'm saying.
And I don't see why
that's necessary. Why it's just execution and it's
I will tell you this. On that subject, I will say this. First of all, my heart goes out to all the Japanese people that have suffered this horrible disaster.
Yes.
Yeah, and of course the Middle Easterners who are having all that problem, and they're trying to change their lives and their government, and they're being gunned down and shot down and hung, and God only knows what's happening to them over there. But my I'll tell you, this is really, maybe it's strange, maybe it's me, but my first thought when I saw our president speak about the travesties going on over there and sending troops over, which I think we should, and I'm all for that, to save the Libyan people from that nut Gaddafi, but I couldn't help it. The first thing my mind clicked on is, well, you know what? We need to do a little of that saving of the people of color over here in this country against these racist white cops that are gunning us down.
Well, my point of view is, why are we looking for terrorists outside the country? There's plenty of them right here.
You got it. You got that right.
And the people
and a lot of them are
to that.
In Yeah, and a lot of them are in higher up positions, you know,
oh,
and they're
absolutely.
Supposed to be public servants, and they're just, you know, it's bad.
And some
so we
of
need
them
to make
are,
some changes over here.
We, definitely, and I really think we need to dump all those old dudes out of the White House and start anew.
I agree.
You know, they've got jobs forever, and some of them are carrying on that old thinking. And you know, right now, the way the politics are, it's not just about people of color. They're going against the American people of all colors.
Yeah, they are.
Now, there's something
they
wrong
are.
With that, you know.
Yeah,
and
well,
I
you
think
know.
That we need to wake up as, you know what I think, though? The best thing
what?
About what's going on is it's going to wake up a bunch of people, and they're going to stop looking at the directions they're pointed. And generally, we're pointed at the direction at each other. But now we need
mm-hmm.
to turn around and follow the money and look at exactly who's doing it. Not
absolutely
pointed
right.
at each other. And that's
absolutely
what they
right,
always do.
Yeah, they're using the divide and conquer methods on us, the brainwashing tactics. And we need to stand up and we need to wake up, like you said, and stop sleepwalking and stop following. You know,
exactly.
stand in your truth and stand in what you know is right and what you know is connected to your God force. And then you won't have to follow these crazy leaders, as they call themselves. You know,
and they're
we
not
have to
even
make...
leading us. They're thinking about themselves. It's all about them and their profit. I mean,
absolutely.
When have we become a country where you're poisoning the people with food, you're polluting the air and the water, you're getting rid of the Board of Education?
Absolutely.
I mean, come on. I mean, all of this stuff that we're doing isn't even making sense anymore.
It doesn't make any sense anymore. Even the way the mass farming treats the animals that it slaughters. You know, I don't have anything against meat eaters, but there is a humane way to raise and slaughter animals for the table. And the government also phased out giving help to the small farmers and the organic farmers, and they're giving the help to these big giant factory-type farms, and those are the ones that are doing the cruelty. And we're eating that cruelty. That's what's
I agree,
scary.
And that's why,
yeah.
Look at the cancer we have. A lot of
sure.
that is what they put in the food and in the water. I mean, you're drinking sodas that they're pushing and they're not healthy. There's so much stuff that we're consuming. We should just be drinking water, to be honest.
Absolutely.
And even that.
It should be purified water.
Exactly. It's about to say
you need to
that
put a purification. You need to put a reverse osmosis purification system on your tap water, because we don't know what's coming out of these wells and these reservoirs either. I mean, you
I
know,
agree.
we don't know what they're pumping to the masses via the water and the products that we eat and drink. And I suspect it's all not good. I know it's not good.
And most of the things
you know what the sad part is,
though, it's not good.
Yeah, but you know what the sad part about that is too, Deirdre? We're at such a horrible station as far as humanity goes, whereby the people who are not making a lot of money can't even afford to eat healthy. Like when I go into the inner city here in Detroit, all they carry in these little stores, the few stores that are junk food, soda,
mm-hmm.
you know, garbage.
That's
and
what
people
Americans
that don't
are
have a car.
Obese.
Yeah.
Look how obese we are. You know,
yeah.
and they're deliberately doing it, and we need to work on our health systems
mm-hmm.
and get that back in order. We need compassionate doctors.
Yep.
People that are thinking of the people and not the profit margin. And that's too, what happened to America, that we became so involved in a profit margin that the people don't matter.
I don't know. But it did happen. It has happened.
Yeah. And it's ongoing, and the people better wake up and change that. And,
that's
and
right.
one way to change it is get rid of all these people. I don't care. It's not about being Republicans or Democrats anymore.
No.
It's not
no,
about
it's not.
That. You know, you
it's
don't
not.
Choose your affiliation over your own kind, your humankind.
That's right.
It's not about that. It's about
it's not. And over,
loving
and over
each
your
other.
Conscience. Yeah, and over your conscience.
Exactly.
Over what you know is right and you know is wrong. I mean, we just have to stand in truth and start keeping our own paths clean and demanding more of the people who are supposed to be representing us, because they're not. But we allow it. we
and
you
face
know
face the our religious values, because we're not we talk good talk, but we're not, our actions are not spiritual, and frankly I follow a spiritual path.
So do I.
I'm not getting into conformity about religion because they're not stepping up to the plate.
No, they're not, and I don't either. I don't do that.
Yep.
I don't do that. I subscribe. If there's anything I would say that I would subscribe to, it would be a Zen Buddhist type way of thinking, whereas you don't want to harm any living thing, and what you think is what you get and what you are. Karma.
Exactly.
Karma.
Exactly.
You know?
And
it's like you can't
be
trying to act
that.
Like you're... Yeah, and it's like you can't be trying to act like you're this great person on the outside and then go home and think all these horrible thoughts about people. You
and
know,
do
I
all
wish
these
people
horrible
did.
Things.
Yeah.
I mean, I see people on the train. Somebody comes by begging. Everybody looks down. And they're only asking for a penny or a nickel. And I say to myself, come on. You mean to say, as bad as things are, you can't reach in your pocket and give a penny or a nickel?
I know. It's very sad.
We've lost sight of the human spirit, and
yes.
If we don't get that back, we're doomed.
I know. We're losing
Seriously.
And have lost a large portion of our humanity. You know,
Indeed.
we have to get compassion back.
And
love
I think
for
it's
one
up
another.
To the artists, and many of the artists feel compassion. Because to be an artist, you suffer to some degree. Nothing is...
Oh, you suffer to a great degree.
Yeah, because nothing is guaranteed.
No, and not only that, I honestly think that the really great artists all come from a place of suffering. That's why they're compelled to express the suffering in their creations. It's, you know, you come from some sort of suffering. And I also think, Deirdre, that people who see more... And who are enlightened carry a heavier load. Because there's a lot of people walking around, they're insensitive, they don't see anything, they're thick, they're dense, and they don't feel anything. They can look at somebody bleeding on the sidewalk and walk over them, or look at an animal
that
needs help.
I have a friend in California. She has never even noticed the mountains are brown. I said, how the hell could you not see that?
Because she's not seeing.
She doesn't look.
No.
She
and if she looks, she doesn't see. Yeah.
She doesn't.
Yeah. With blinders on.
It amazes me. It amazes me how many people are like that, though. It's not just her.
Mm-mm. It's not just her. But I do think that those of us that see more and are more enlightened do carry a much heavier load. That's why we're in pain so much, and we suffer and we cry when we see something disturbing, either on the street or on television, or see someone or something wounded. It hurts. It hurts us because we're the ones that still have compassion.
Well, you know, a part of the Bible says, suffer little children to come unto me, and I don't think people really understand what that means. But I really think that, in a sense, that black people are suffering, but it's to come unto the divine.
Yep.
It's to come onto the divine, because suffering opens up a compassionate heart. And if you notice,
right.
Most people of color are in service.
It
I
is.
I mean, if money takes you to the point that you've lost sight of the world around you, that you feel above it, then you are poor indeed, no matter how wealthy
That's right.
you are.
That's exactly right. I'd rather be spiritually rich than financially rich. There's no two ways about that. I want to sleep at night.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we have come to the end of our show.
Okay.
And
let's remind the Chicago audience that Saturday and Sunday I'm at the Hilton Rosemont at O'Hare Airport doing the celebrity show with people like Elliot Gould, Bruce Dern, Roger Mosley, Leslie Ann Warren, even Jenna James, fellas. Jenna James is going to be there.
Wow.
All the guys know who that is. But anyway, we'll be at the Rosemont Hilton tomorrow from 10 to 4, and then Sunday from 10 to 4, signing autographs and taking people pictures with people and meeting our fans. So I hope everybody comes out to that, too.
And I want to, again, say to the folks that are going to catch you at the Algonquin Hotel, and that she's going to be in the Oak Room for reservations, call 212 419-9331 or go online at www.algonquinhotel.com.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome, and thank you so much for being my guest today.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. And this is
thank
Deirdre Schulz signing off on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul and thanking my audience and Lynette McKee for making my topically yours. And we're going to close the show with Lynette's song, Dream of You.